Well, as always, special greeting to our video audience. There was almost 2,000 of you this past week, and it's always good to have you with us. But it's better if you come in here, so show up next Sunday. What we're going to talk about tonight or today is reducing the darkness. Just want to get you started by thinking about things that you've stepped on while you were walking in the dark. You know, when my kids were little, they strategically placed Legos wherever they thought I would walk without shoes on. And you know what hurts even more than the Legos are these little Hot Wheels cars. Those things can make you scream. And for whatever reason, we have a coffee table that sat in the same spot for over 25 years. And I always find that when I'm barefoot for some reason or another. It always happens. We used to have a dog, and that dog would, you know, as it got older, was not very good at making it to the door. And I would step in that and have that oozing up between my toes and things like that. You know, it's something to think about when you're about to eat too much. And then there's things that are left on the steps, you know, that even if they're set way off to the side, I find them and step on them. It's an amazing thing. But I was just wondering for you now, what's the worst thing you've ever stepped on in the dark? You know, I was thinking about that myself. I stepped, you know, in living in Oklahoma for 5 years, the cockroaches get about that big. And I stepped on a few of those barefoot in the dark. But I think the worst thing happened right here in Michigan. I was in my basement one night, and we have two bedrooms down there, and there's storage rooms now. And I turned the lights out, and I know where the steps are. And I was walking to the steps, and I stepped in something that was warm and squishy. I thought, now what in the world is this? So I turned the light on. It was a mouse. And the mouse did not survive my 250 pounds. But you know, that's probably the worst thing. Now, the thing is, I could have turned the light on. Then I wouldn't have done that. Then I wouldn't step on things like mice or cockroaches or anything like that. But I didn't turn the light on. And I think that's a metaphor for our souls a lot of the time. We live in spiritual darkness that comes to us. Now, you know, life is normally dark. You know, that's just the way it is. Happiness is quite elusive. And I don't think we're supposed to be happy all the time. I think that's a myth created by Madison Avenue and all the advertisers on television. You ever notice how every time there's a new drug out, the people that are taking that drug are just ecstatically happy? They just can't get, you know, buy this drug that's not yet covered by insurance, and then you'll be happy and healthy and all that good stuff. But that's not reality. You know, happiness is quite often an illusion. Happiness is not our default position. But sometimes we have extra unhappiness. A dark night of the soul is what I call it. It's a time where we're hit with confusion. We feel helpless. There's a stagnation of our will. And there's a sense of the withdrawal of God's presence. It's definitely a time of testing. And then with the dark night of the soul, we often step in things that make it even darker. Now, to use a metaphor with this, you know, we don't generate the electricity. Consumers' energy pipes electricity to all our houses, but we can flip the switch to reduce the darkness. You know, dark nights of the soul have been around as long as humans have been around. And if you're not in a dark night now, chances are you will be sometime in the near future. Is there a way to get out of these? And that's what I want to look at today. We were looking at a teaching from Isaiah. And because I want to turn you all into Bible scholars or Bible nerds like me, I want to give you a little background on the prophet Isaiah. It's an Old Testament book, 66 chapters. Originally, it was three different books. There's three Isaiahs, And I kind of outlined them on this slide. Part one is, they call Proto-Isaiah, chapters 1 through 39, and it was written by the original Isaiah, the man who lived about 700 BC, and it was before the exile to Babylon and the destruction of the temple. Now, what's going on there is, you know, Isaiah couldn't have lived long enough to see the conquest of Nebuchadnezzar. But then, while the Israelis were slaves in Babylon, another fellow wrote chapters 40 to 55. It's an anonymous author who tacked it on to the Isaiah series. It was added later. And then third, Trito Isaiah, was written by another anonymous author after the exile. You know, what happened was the Persians came in, overthrew the Babylonians, and the Persians let the Jews go back to their homeland. So this book of Isaiah covers about 110 years, or 100 years, something like that. And it has a lot of what we call predictive prophecy in it. But in order to understand predictive prophecy, you got to understand human free will. See, God can predict things that are going to happen, but humans have historically thwarted those predictions. And so a lot of times those predictions don't happen the way God said they were going to happen, because he gives us a choice to mess it up. And humans usually do. So when we read the predictive prophecy in Isaiah, you have to understand it's in light of the free will. Now, Isaiah has certain themes of light and darkness, and themes of wisdom and folly. We're going to look at chapter 9 today, which is in Proto-Isaiah. It's before the exile. And it's a prediction of a coming light that never happened, because free will was the factor. See, God can promise good things, and he does. He supplies power to the light switch, but we still have to turn it on. He lets us control the switch. So this is how chapter 9 reads. Nevertheless, that time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. The land of Zebulun and Naphtali will be humbled. But there will be a time in the future when Galilee of the Gentiles, which lies along the road that runs between the Jordan and the sea, will be filled with glory. See, he's making that point that darkness and despair always pass. You know, things always look better in the spring. You know, these two major population centers at the time, Zebulun and Naphtali, were destroyed. And destroyed so much that we hardly know where they are today, because there's nothing left. The Babylonians just mowed them down. And they were humbled. But he says, Galilee will be filled with glory. And glory in the Old Testament means the heaviness of God's presence. So that's what he's predicting here. And then he goes on and says this: the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. For those who live in a land of deep darkness, a light will shine. So he's saying, the light's coming. Now, folks, this was 2,500 years before the invention of electricity. These folks had no idea what electricity was. They depended on fire for light and oil lamps and, of course, sunlight. But here, the walking in the darkness is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the damaged soul. It's a metaphor for spiritual blindness. And the prophet says, this will end, and you'll see a great light. He goes on, he says, you will enlarge the nation of Israel, and its people will rejoice. They will rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, and like warriors dividing the plunder. So he's predicting the liberation of Israel from Babylon. And when that happened, it was a major time of rejoicing. He says, for you will break the yoke of their slavery and lift the heavy burden from their shoulders. You'll break the oppressor's rod, just as you did when you destroyed the army of Midian. He's saying their slavery is going to end. He's going to break the oppressor's rod. You know, people who were enslaved in those days, they had kind of a walking stick that the slave masters would beat them with if they weren't doing the thing the way they were supposed to. That rod is going to be broken, he said. Now, he says, just like you did when you destroyed the army of Midian. And that bears a little rabbit trail to figure out what he was talking about there. But that was at a time with this old boy of Gideon. This is a Sunday school picture of it, but it's effective anyway. Gideon was leading Israel, and the Midianite army was trying to come in and take over, just like the Romans did during the time of Jesus. Now, Gideon was leading 32,000 soldiers, and God told him to send all but 300 of them home. And the way he did that, he took his soldiers to the river, and the ones that stuck their head in the water and sucked the water out were the ones that had to go home. And those that picked the water up by their hands and drank that way, they could stay. Or vice versa. I don't remember which is which. But anyway, he sent all but 300 soldiers home. And then at night, he lit torches and put those torches, he hid them in burning torches in clay pots. And then they surrounded the Midianite camp. And at the stroke of midnight, they broke the clay pots, held the lights up, and blew on ram's horns, which would have made a horrendous sound. You know, we get tired of listening to leaf blowers. This was even worse. You know, and what happened is the Midianite soldiers panicked. They had no idea what was out there. So they turned on each other. They started killing each other. And, you know, they were totally confused. And then the ones that didn't get killed fled. Israel won without having to lift a sword. And so that's what he's talking about here. He goes on, says, the boots of the warrior and the uniforms bloodstained by war will all be burned. They will be fuel for the fire. And that story of Gideon, by the way, is from Judges chapter 7. But here we see, too, that, well, there's no need for uniforms anymore because there's not going to be any need for soldiers. Peace is going to be imminent. That has never happened in the Middle East. Then it goes on, and here's a passage that you're all going to be familiar with that you hear at least every year in December. For a child is born to us, a son is given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders, and he'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, was Isaiah predicting Jesus here? I don't think so. I don't think he had a clue that that was coming. A lot of people say Jesus fulfilled this prophecy. And that is true, depending on what you mean by fulfilled. Fulfilled prophecy just means that there's another layer of meaning added to the existing prophecy. And in that sense, yes, Jesus did fulfill this because he did add another layer of meaning to this prophecy. But this didn't happen exactly as Isaiah had predicted. He says this too. He says, his government and its peace will never end. He will rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. Well, there's nobody on that throne today in Jerusalem, you know, so we're a little concerned about that. But the Jewish people were looking for a political king, and they were disappointed. See, predictive prophecy always changes based on human response, based on human behavior, based on how we react to it. God will let us sin if we want to. And he can promise never-ending peace, and he can intend to send a fair king, but if people don't want this, he won't do it. And then, as is now, the people were more interested in prosperity than they were in God. And he concludes this narrative by saying this, the passionate commitment of the Lord of heaven's armies will make this happen. So the Lord predicts this, He's passionately committed to it. Why didn't it happen? It didn't happen simply because people preferred darkness to light. That's a theme that's often talked about in the Gospel of John. Jesus uses the light metaphor often too, as this passage shows. And this is from John 8. It's right after the portion of scripture where the people were going to stone the woman caught in adultery. And right immediately after it, this picks it up. It says, Jesus spoke to the people once more and said, I am the light of the world. If you follow me, you won't have to walk in darkness because you will have the light that leads to life. So here's the simple thing. You want to end your darkness? You want to end the dark night of the soul? Then follow Jesus. Then you will have the light. See, dark times just happen to all of us, where motivation dies, procrastination seems to rule, not getting anything done, and you don't feel like doing anything. And then a cloud of pessimism descends and gets very thick, and I've been there many times. I think it's God's way of getting our attention. I think the dark night of the soul is God's call to us. So when I'm there, I don't always respond positively. But when I do respond well, I pray and ask him what he wants me to do. And instantly I know, pops right into my head. And if I get busy doing it, whatever it is, the darkness fades. When you report for duty, the lights come back on. That's Jesus' formula for reducing the darkness. And his formula absolutely works. You follow him and the darkness fades. And if you use the metaphor of light and darkness, you know, we don't have to create the electricity. Consumers Power pipes it into our homes. But we do control the switch. We have to flip the switch to receive the light. And the difference between being in the dark and being in the light is flipping the switch. Then we receive God's light. I've had some experiences with actual physical darkness. Wind Cave National Park, it's in the Black Hills of South Dakota. It's a place worth visiting. I've been there several times as a kid, and then just a few years ago we went back there. And it's really an interesting place. It's called Wind Cave because it's long and narrow. And whenever the atmospheric pressure changes, you know, when the barometer goes up or down, wind comes out of that cave. And so the first European settlers there were walking along and they saw this hole in the ground with, you know, wind coming out of it like a leaf blower or whatever. You know, it was just blowing out of that cave. Hence the name Wind Cave. And for those, I was surprised how many people in the first service understood that that's not a buffalo bull, that's a cow. That's a female, and she's using that sign as a scratching post in this particular picture of it. But, you know, that cave in South Dakota has tours. It's closed right now for the season. I looked it up. But you can take a tour of that. And what you do is you go through these really narrow passageways. Like I had to turn sideways to get all of me through it. And you go down in there maybe 300-400 yards. Then the tour guide turns the lights off. And it is absolutely black darkness. You literally can't see your hand in front of your face. And, you know, I was there with a couple of family members who grabbed my arms. And the next day I could see imprints yet from how tightly I was squeezed. But it's a privilege to be squeezed in the dark, you know. But it was the darkest I've ever seen. You know, people got scared. And then the tour guide flipped the lights back on. And there were sighs of relief and applause and giggling and all that. Because they were so relieved to have light again. Now, metaphorically for this, you can have light in your darkest times. The solution is simple. Flip the switch by following Jesus. Flip the switch and you'll see the darkness disappear. You can reduce the darkness by following Jesus. Let's believe this good news and live in peace. Would you pray with me, please? Lord, sometimes we enter into darkness that can't be helped, but most of the time when we're in the darkness, it's because of things that we have precipitated. So again, we ask for your forgiveness. We report for duty and ask for your help in showing us how to reduce the darkness in our own lives and in our own souls. So this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.